Good morning. Another full house today for our argument. That's very nice. My notes tell me that the students from Bigfoot High School are here. If they are, would they please stand? Oh, very good. Where is Bigfoot High School?
Down by Lake
Geneva. Ah, okay. Please, you may be seated. If you all can stay when this argument is over, I'll come down after the lawyers pack up their toys and move out and chat with you all a little bit about the Supreme Court and answer some questions. We won't talk about the substance of the case, but really about the procedures that go on before a case comes to the Supreme Court. So, and hopefully create some new lawyers out there that might be interested, right? Okay. Now, the second case, before I call it, you will note that the chair where Justice Shirley Abrahamson usually sits is empty. Sometimes she participates by phone. That is not the case today. She has withdrawn from participation in this case, so we will sit six. I'll call the case then. Teske versus Corrado Cirillo. Am I saying it correctly? Well, thank you very much. Are you prepared to begin? Please do.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Corrado Cirillo, and I represent Wilson Mutual Insurance Company in this case. With me here today is attorney Joshua McKinley from my law firm of Olson, Cloyd, Gunderson, and Conway. The case that we are here today to decide and argue about is a tragic accident that happened on Highway 23 in Fond du Lac County. It happened on November 24th, 2013. It involved four family members, the Teskes, the mother, Julie Teske, the driver, Emily Teske, and the two minor daughters, Ellie and Catherine. It was a very severe accident. I can't say that enough. It was severe. They were going to church on a Sunday, St. Paul's Lutheran Church, and they were rear-ended while Emily was waiting to make a left turn into the church parking lot. Her car was propelled into the oncoming eastbound lane where it was struck by a third vehicle driven by a nun, Patrice Raj, and the brief says that they suffered over $700,000. I can't emphasize enough how bad this was. Fortunately, they all lived. They started a suit under Julie Teske's name on January 29th, 2014 in Milwaukee County. And the only parties were the driver that had the rear end, the driver that hit him in the rear end of their vehicle, and Julie Teske, the mother, and State Farm Insurance Company, which was the insurer for Sabrina Schrock, the person that was in the car that hit the Teskes from behind. This was negotiated because it was pretty clear who was liable. It was pretty clear that the available insurance was going to be exhausted almost immediately. The insurance that was available was $300,000 by State Farm on a per accident limit. The insurance, the underinsured motorist insurance that the Teskes themselves had was a $500,000 policy, $500,000 per person, $500,000 per accident. With the reducing clause, there was a negotiation between Wilson Mutual and the Teskes attorney whereby they would pay $245,000, and with the $255,000 that was paid by State Farm, they would reach their $500,000 policy limit. $45,000 went to the nun, Ms. Raj. This went to a minor settlement hearing in Milwaukee in front of Judge Hanscher, and everybody that had any interest in this case attended. Now, the pleadings from the first case in Milwaukee County, as I said, did not include Wilson Mutual in the pleadings. We were not formally named a party. But that's not unusual because in minor settlements, and I never realized this in my first 5 years of practicing law, but in the last 12 years, I've done about 45, 50 minor settlements, both as a GAL and for insurance companies. A lot of times, The insurance company is not named, is never named, if it goes to minor settlement, unless there's a lawsuit. Because a lot of times the parents will reach tentative settlement with the insurance company based on the minors. The court will ask for some GAL to be appointed, and you're on your way to the courthouse with a petition for approval of minor settlement, an order approval of minor settlement, usually a structured settlement, annuity plan, or something of that nature.
Counsel, isn't the reason perhaps that the insurance company is not always actually named is because the insurance company is in privity with the named parties?
Well, and sometimes, you're right, Justice Kelly, often the insurance company is not named. And in this case, we were not named, even though we were definitely in privity with all of the Teskeys. And I discussed that in the second element of the claim preclusion. In the first element of the claim preclusion, identity of parties, that the insurance company is often in privity with one of the insurers through its UIM contract, but definitely if someone is sued for the accident, as we have in the second case where the mother, father, and the two minor daughters are suing their sister and their daughter, here Emily, there's no doubt there's privity between Wilson Mutual and Emily, because under the duty to defend of an insurance contract, liability contract, we have to step up to the plate and provide Emily a defense. And that's why we're here in the second case. But what happened in the first case is a little bit different in that after the minor settlement was adjudicated, there was a venue change based on the locality of Wilson Mutual being a corporate entity in Sheboygan County. And both parties did cross motions for declaratory judgment because there was dispute as to whether or not the reducing clause applied. And that was litigated. The Sheboygan County Circuit Court, Judge Angela Sukiewicz, ruled in favor of Wilson Mutual. It was appealed. It went to the Court of Appeals, and I believe the exact same judges who decided the second case decided the first case, if I'm not mistaken.
So, counsel, let me see if I can drill down to where I don't think I'm quite getting this case. So, in the first case, negligence was an issue, right?
Actually, it was the issue. The negligence had to start. How can I put it, Justice Kelly? UIM claims just don't fall out of the sky. There's got to be an underlying tort. It's got to be connected to underlying tort. And there's a case that I cite, the Gillette case, which is actually a conflict of laws case because the accident happened, I believe it was in Canada, and it came back to Wisconsin for a UIM claim. And this court stated that this is where tort law, the negligence claim, and contract law, the UIM claim, collide.
Yeah.
I mean, they're intertwined. You cannot have one without the other. And it arises from the accident,
right,
the act of negligence.
So let's take that as a given. And then which family members were parties to the first case?
The very first case, before there was an amendment to the pleading, was just the mother, Julie Teske. There was an amendment of pleadings after it went, which and then moved to Sheboygan, and they added the two minor daughters. They did not add Emily, and they did not add the father, John Teske, who had been represented by counsel, as the settlement documents make very clear in the prior case. And I want to clarify, John Teske was not involved in the accident. He made a claim for out-of-pocket costs, and he received $20,000 from the settlement. So this, you know, there's an argument that he has no interest in this case. If he has no interest, I don't know why he's getting $20,000. I mean, I got to be frank with you. That's weird to me for someone to make that kind of presentation argument. He has an interest. He's the father. Okay. I mean, he's got a loss of consortium claim, a loss of companionship claim, if he wants to bring that.
Yeah. So let's look at the three family members who were parties to the first case. So negligence was at issue. There, and didn't they then have a responsibility to bring up Emily's negligence in that case?
Yeah, well, I mean, the claim preclusion cases that I've looked at, and there's quite a few, but it makes clear that if you might bring a claim, might, and the case that I'm thinking of is, if I'm not mistaken, is is the Krukenberg case, I believe, or no, excuse me, it's the Menard Lightweight case at paragraph 26. It states, a final judgment is conclusive in all subsequent actions between the same parties or their privies, and I think we have privies here, as to all matters which were litigated or which might have been litigated in the former proceedings. And that's unquote right there. That's a direct quote from our case law, and that's a Supreme Court case. And Menard's Lightway was a compulsory counterclaim lawsuit where Menard should have brought their claim in another case that they were involved with the same plaintiff because they had a six-year relationship that spanned, you know, getting lights back and forth and some lights being defective and whether or not to make a claim based on those lights and their defectiveness.
Right. So now I want to get that set up so I can distinguish that from John. So John was not a party.
John was not a party, but I believe he was a party in all but name, and that's coming right from my brief, John.
Right. Indeed it does. But isn't that all but name, isn't that significant?
It is, but if it was significant, in all cases where you have minor settlements and there's parties that are not named, such as an insurance company, and there's a settlement, and the insurance company is supposed to, you know, be on its happy way, all of a sudden someone gets unhappy and wants to sue the person, I mean, even though they weren't there and unnamed, don't they have the benefit of a claim preclusion or... this was, or a claim or defense saying this was settled by contract. I think they would have both, Justice Kelly.
Would you agree that John was not in privity with his family members with respect to his injury?
I would agree with that. For a simple reason, my understanding of case law, derivative lawsuits for companionship claims or consortium claims, it's an independent derivative of what Julie's claim would be, his wife's claim. So, and to that extent, I think that would survive. But in this case, I don't think it does because he could have brought that claim in the minor settlement, even though he was not named, because he did bring a claim for out-of-pocket costs, and he did receive money.
So this minor settlement, to the extent that it involves non-named parties, isn't that just more like a mediation?
I would like to say it is more like a mediation, but these minor settlements actually lead to sometimes an order with prejudice and dismissal on the merits, which is a final judgment. They're not quite like that because the order, you know, tells everybody what happens to the money, what happens to the disbursements, and it's done.
And is that binding on the non-parties to the case?
Would it be I if they're getting money, I believe they would, because they've gotten a remedy for one of their claims or many of their claims.
And claim is that's an important word, right? So claim is something that you bring to court in the form of a complaint. Yeah. So if your participation in a minor settlement results in you receiving funds, but you are not a party to the case and therefore have not formally asserted a claim, how can there be the potential for claim preclusion when you've never asserted one?
Well, the claim wasn't made in like a complaint, Justice Kelly. The claim here was made in the petition for approval where he claimed that he wanted $20,000 for out-of-pocket costs and other things. So in that sense, it's a claim. But more importantly, in one of the settlement documents, he's identified as a claimant, and he agrees to that. He agrees as that he's a claimant. I mean, he signs off on the paperwork, and more importantly, he was represented by counsel. It isn't like he went in there blind. I think that's really important.
Is there a distinction to be made between a claim in the sense of I have a claim for insurance proceeds from an insurance company versus a legal claim? A claim you bring in a complaint. Is there a distinction between
those? I don't make much of a distinction between the two for the simple reason claims can be made at a negotiation stage, and if the negotiation fails, it can turn into a lawsuit where you get formal pleadings and a formal written-out claim for negligence and damages and things of that nature. But I think a claim is still a claim. And I did not mention the law regarding what this court considers a claim, but the idea when an insurance company gets a claim, they immediately have a duty to defend, even if it's not in court. They immediately take control of the case, negotiate with the party that's making the claim, try to come to some reasonable negotiation. That's how it usually works. And then they may get a settlement. In minor settlement cases, there's no formal pleadings, usually. This one did have formal pleadings, where there was a pleading of negligence against the tortfeasor, Sabrina Srock, and her insurance company. So
have
I think...
Have we ever decided that claim preclusion applies to someone who is not a named party or in privity with a named party?
As this court, I'm trying to think of one, and I didn't put any in my brief, so I think there is one, but I cannot say for sure right now. I think there is one, but I cannot point you to one, Justice Kelly, to be fair. Well, anyway, the question as here is whether there was an identity between the causes of action. I think there is an identity of the parties and privities, because at least three of the Teske family members were named in the amended pleadings for UIM claim. And there's some debate as to whether this was really a UIM claim or just a debate as to the interpretation of the reducing clause. There's no debate here in my mind. I mean, if you look at the amended complaint, paragraphs 7, 8, and 9, it spells out quite clearly that this is a UIM claim. And as I said before, UIM claims don't just fall from the sky. They got to be connected with an accident and someone having damages and someone not having enough insurance to cover those damages. That's exactly what we have here. There's no doubt about that. Turning to the second element of claim preclusion is whether
before
there's...
Before you turn that page, I want to make sure I understand the ramifications of your argument. And I hear you really putting a fine point on emphasizing that this is a UIM claim, of course, based on contract, the insurance contract, but it's unlike other contractual claims that may arise when interpreting an insurance contract. It's almost what we say, sui generis. Is that what you're advancing?
Justice Bradley, I think you hit the nail on the head here, because there's got to be some type of action that triggers the UIM claim, is what I'm saying. I think that's what you may be pointing out here. It's different.
I'm not pointing out anything.
Okay.
I want to make sure that I understand the contours of your argument.
Right. And I think the question you're posing makes sense to me. I mean, the contract for UIM is triggered by something, not just the contract itself. It's got to be triggered by a couple conditions. One, there's got to be a tortfeasor. There's got to be someone that got into an accident with a person that has a UIM contract with their insurance company. Two, there's got to be damages. Okay? It is.
But don't those things go to, let's say there was a question on coverage because the question arose whether or not there was a permissive use of the driver.
Sure.
You know, that's whether or not that person, under the terms of the contract, so here's a contract claim where you need an accident, you need damages. So if those are your limiting propositions, I say that's no limitation at all. I want to know what the consequences or the ramifications are of your argument that really make this contractual dispute sui generis, limited, not applicable to other insurance personal auto insurance cases where, by definition, generally, there's an auto accident and there's damages. What more? What makes this unique?
What makes
this tight and narrow?
Sure. And this, I think this is a case of first impression, to be quite frank with you, Justice Bradley, at least for this court, as to where we have a UIM claim and a negligence claim and then claim preclusion being raised. I haven't found one, and neither did the Court of Appeals. We had to use foreign jurisdiction to, you know, tackle that issue. But is it unlimited? No, because of this strange nature of UIM claims, and it's in my brief, one thing that happens when an insurance company gets a UIM claim, they look at who's negligent. Is there comparative negligence? Is there enough insurance? If there is insurance, they get the benefit of various, the UIM carrier steps into the shoes of the tortfeasor if it has to defend. It can bring defenses of mitigation. It can bring a seatbelt defense. It can bring all those things. So what we're looking to is what's the common nucleus of operative fact when you're making a UIM claim, and we're also using claim preclusion for a negligence claim.
But, counsel, the negligence claim could have been brought in the same lawsuit, correct?
Of course it could have. And that's the whole point of what I said, Chief Justice Rogan said. If they might have been able to bring it, they should have bring it. And there's other case law that says they're required to bring it. That is the Krukenberg case. They're required to bring it. I mean, the facts here of the UIM claim and the negligence claim are hand in glove. I mean, they are. I mean, you've got to look at what the original tortfeasor did, whether the UIM carrier can avail itself of the defenses that the tortfeasor would bring. These are interrelated. I mean, and they stem from one thing. All the claims stem from one thing, and that's the November 2013 accident. It doesn't stem from anything else. Now, there's an argument made that, the UIM claim came later. Considering the gravity and the seriousness of this accident and the level of, medical specialists suffered by the four Teskeys in their car, there is no doubt on day one, UIM claim.
But isn't this specifically we're not just talking about a general UIM claim, you're talking about the issue is the reducing clause. Isn't that a contract issue separate and apart from the underlying facts of the case? They're not stepping into the shoes of the tortfeasor to defend whether the reducing clause applies, right?
How do we get to even debating the reducing clause unless there's a UIM claim and an accident?
Of course there's an accident. That goes without saying, but there can be all kinds of breaches of contract that stem from an activity that's separate and apart from the breach. So, yes, I grant you there's an accident. Tie it up for me, though, and this goes, I think, along with what Justice Bradley was asking. This is a very specific UIM claim. So how is this different? How is this something that is connected to the underlying facts when all you're talking about is the application of that contractual piece?
That's the argument that's made by the plaintiffs, is whether or not debating the interpretation of a reducing clause is really somehow different from the negligence claim. Well, the negligence claim that was made against Sabrina Schrock, the original tortfeasor, another negligence claim could have been made against Emily at the exact same time. And what's really important about talking about reducing clause, there's something in my brief about the duplication of payments. Okay, one of the problems that an insurer has is when they issue a policy for $500,000, they don't want to be paying $745,000 as what might happen here. Because if Emily is found to be negligent in a court of law, all of a sudden, there's another $500,000 there unless we get the duplication of payments and the exhaustion clauses, which originally trigger UIM. Because UIM may not have been triggered if they sued Emily and was found negligent. She was found negligent, and then they paid $500,000 on the liability. They cannot then claim another $500,000 in UIM. So what the plaintiffs are trying to do here is get more than the $500,000 they got, as according to the contract they have with Wilson, both in UIM and liability. And that's the problem here, Justice Dellett. That's why it's interrelated, and it's not just, we can't sit there and just say, it's just the reducing clause, it's really nothing else. This is all interconnected. I mean, the contract works that way in UIM cases, and that's why the majority of plaintiffs, almost all, if there's a UIM claim and negligence on the host driver is alleged here, you bring them in right away. For a simple reason, you want to exhaust the liability limits before you make your UIM claim. The plaintiffs didn't do that, and that's the problem. And that's what we're defending here, part of it. And I don't go into great detail in my brief about it, but it's pretty obvious based on the cases that do talk about the exhaustion of the limits as well as duplication of payments, that's not allowed. You're not supposed to do that, okay? And that's why I think claim preclusion does apply here, and that's why I think there is an identity between the causes of action here. I mean, how can I put it? I mean, there's construction claims that I've worked where you got all these various subcontractors and contractors that argue over who's at fault, and someone brings up what has been referred to this court as the blob, the economic loss doctrine, and, you know, they argue that doctrine, and then they come back with another suit based on negligence in a different case. They should have brought the contract case and the negligence case together. I mean, that's what we have here. They could have done that. And our jurisprudence says they have to do it. It's not you may or you should or you might. They have to. If they might bring it, then they have to bring it. No doubt about that. That's what our case law says, and that's why this is brought up. I mean, one of the things the Court of Appeals argued for its own reason was that these are total legal, different legal theories. The identity between the causes of action under the Restatement of Judgments, Section 24, so what? You can have different legal theories. You can have different remedies. You can have different claims. If they arise from one common nucleus of operative fact, you have to bring them. And that's what we have here. That's what we have here. There's no doubt it's all about this accident. And like I said, it's tragic. And, you know, being the insurer of the people that got hurt, it's difficult to make this argument because I feel for them. I met them. They're good people. They're very good people.
And your argument with respect to the first element, the privity of the parties, is that John was, in fact, because he was represented by counsel, because he received money from a minor settlement, that he is a party, despite the fact that he has no ability to challenge anything in court because he wasn't a party.
But, Justice Dallas, he was represented by a lawyer. Lawyers are pretty sophisticated as to what they can do and not do. I mean, this isn't simply, you know, John has no remedy.
Right, but so our test, let me just get that clear what you're saying, though. You want our test to be whether they're represented by a lawyer?
No. Your Honor, if they are getting a remedy in court, and I see my time.
You can answer Justice Dallet's question.
If they are asking for a remedy, if they are being recognized in the court, if there are pleadings, which petitions for approval of minor settlement are pleadings, if the court is issuing orders saying, yes, this man gets money, aren't they a party in all but name? I mean, they're getting everything they could get from a lawsuit if they had filed a lawsuit. I mean, that's my argument there.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Attorney Keith Trower. I represent the Teske family. I'm from the Warshefsky Law Firm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Morning, Justices. I want to go over the procedural history of this case a little bit because I think that's a key point in determining what's the difference between the first litigation and the second litigation. As counsel stated, it was a horrific auto accident. A horrific auto accident, November 24th of 2013. Medical bills, close to $1 million. Julie Teske suffered a broken pelvis, displaced in four places, suffered a fracture in her spine and had to be fused at T4 and through T7. Ellie Teske was knocked unconscious and was in a coma for 3 days, ended up having a broken femur and having to be pinned with a rod.
Counsel, I agree that the injuries were really significant. We can certainly tell that from $700,000 in special damages. My question to you is, do you agree, as opposing counsel has said, that both the UIM claim, that was the first lawsuit, and the current lawsuit both require the November 2013 accident?
To an extent, yes.
Could either one of them have taken place without it?
Auto accidents occur all the time without UIM claims and without UIM coverage.
No, but that
claims.
Wasn't my question.
I understand.
My question was for this case.
Yep.
Okay. Could either of these lawsuits have gone forward without the November 2013 accident?
No.
So they both start at the same place and they both require that accident, correct?
Yes, to an extent.
Right. Just so I'm sure on where we are.
And they both require negligence on someone's part.
I would say so, that an auto accident matter, in order to have a claim to be made against a tortfeasor, has to be negligence, yes.
If you're right, should the minor settlement be unwound and the case be consolidated so that there can be a full hearing and trial on the merits of everything? I mean, because what authority also does the court have to order a non-party to make a payment?
Order a non-party to make a
in
payment.
In the order, the minor settlement, Wilson.
Right.
Was Wilson, the insurance company that paid.
Wilson is, there's two payments that are made, one by State Farm.
Right.
And then one by Wilson Insurance, correct?
Right.
Right.
And the minor settlement requires payments by whom?
Minor settlements occur all the time with non-parties making payments. That's not the interest of the minor settlement. The minor settlement, as the court may know, is related to making sure that the minors of the matter are protected and are receiving their fair share of the settlement proceeds.
Right, but that was in the lawsuit that involves State Farm, right?
That's right.
And Wilson was not yet a party to that, right?
Correct.
But Wilson is, unless I read the minor settlement wrong, which I don't think I did, the court order of minor settlement required Wilson to make a payment.
That is correct.
Okay, so what was the court's authority to order Wilson to make a payment if Wilson's not a party and the court had no authority and Wilson there was no claim preclusion?
Sure. Again, the procedural history, I can speak to that, and it's going to be a little of a long answer if that's okay. The procedural history is that this matter occurs, and the first thing that's filed is a petition to protect evidence on behalf of Julie Teske to acquire the cell phone of Sabrina Schrock. At the time, it was to investigate whether or not there may be another related tortfeasor to Sabrina Schrock's that day. A then complaint is filed, only on behalf of Julie Teske, against Sabrina Schrock in order to discard the discovery process. Immediately following, there's a motion to compel that is made to State Farm and Sabrina Schrock to produce that cell phone. That's the purpose of that first litigation. Yes, negligence is alleged, but that negligence is never litigated, never to a final merits.
Right, there's a settlement. I mean, there are Perringer releases, there's partial settlement and release. Wilson Mutual is a signator to that. So are all the parties that are parties to the second lawsuit. So what does that have any relevance?
Well, it does in that there is an open matter filed with the court that currently has jurisdiction on the incident. And I think it was judicial economy by the lawyers that matter is open, instead of filing a new matter with court for the petition, that you use the open matter that was already there.
If both of these claims were brought together and litigated in one rather than two lawsuits, what is the maximum Wilson would pay?
I don't have that answer to that because that hasn't been briefed or discussed in terms of
what's their policy?
Their policy is a maximum of $500,000 per person, per occurrence, both bodily injury and UIM coverage. Though those coverages are different and operate differently.
Okay.
Counsel, I think part of this case may come down to the question of privity, who's in privity. And that is, in part, because in order for claim preclusion to bar a suit, there must be three elements must be fulfilled. Number one, an identity between the parties or their privies in the prior and present suit. I want to focus on John and Emily and ask and see if they were parties in the prior or present, or if they had a relationship in privity with a party in the prior. Certainly they're bringing an action now. John is bringing an action in this current suit. So work through that with me, if you will.
Sure. In terms of John Teske, John Teske does not make a demand under the UIM claim to Wilson Insurance. He only makes a demand for time and energy spent to take care of his family and the
That's
cost that's incurred.
That's not very. I didn't make my question clear.
Sorry.
Was John Teske a party in the prior suit?
He was not.
Was he in privity with anyone in the prior suit?
I don't believe he was.
Tell me why he wasn't in privity.
Because he doesn't have a UIM claim. He didn't make a UIM claim. He's not presenting a UIM claim.
Well,
the UIM claim is owned by the individual person who is recovered from the initial money spent or expended by State Farm, then has a claim to recover what is their owed under their own insurance policy.
So if it's your position, since that he was not a party in the prior suit and he wasn't in privity relationship in the prior suit, that the first element necessary for claim preclusion cannot be met. Is that what you're advancing?
That is. I would also say that Emily Teske also is not in privity or a party to the prior suit.
Where you're answering Justice Bradley's question, I'm really interested. What about Julie? Does that fit at all with John in regard to her question for privity?
What do you mean, Your Honor?
Julie was a party in the first action, so I think that's what Justice Bradley was looking at. I'm sorry. Well, then go ahead. I thought you were looking at claim preclusion, which required party or privity, and I thought you were on trying to identify if John had a privity in the first action.
Yes, and the response was that he was not a party or had no privity, and now you're going to Emily, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
But if you can, to the extent, incorporate the concern I think I hear from you that whether or not there's a privity relationship that's in existence.
Right, that's what's in your mind.
So
yeah,
work
right.
through this.
In terms of Julie's UIM claim, Julie is limited to the proceeds that she has under the policy, right? So there's $500,000 per person per occurrence, correct? So she has a limited claim that she can make based on hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical bills that greatly exceed that amount. So her claim is going to, just alone, would cap the $500,000 limit both from State Farm and from Wilson Insurance.
And just because Julie's married to John does not make John in privity with Julie.
I would.
That's what's bothering me.
Okay. Exactly. It depends in terms of the nature of the claim.
This claim, UIM,
yes.
This first suit.
I don't think in the first suit that he has privity to her because she's solely making a claim for her own injuries.
Okay, so it's her injuries. It has nothing to do with his loss of consortium, his taking off work, any other claims
he
could have.
But he got $20,000 for it.
He did from State Farm. That's correct. But he also did not make a claim for UIM claim in the claim process with Wilson Insurance in the, you know, April of 2014. I think that's the key difference.
You're distinguishing the UIM from the minor settlement.
I am, yes.
And how do those get distinguished for purposes of the first claim?
For purposes of what?
The first claim.
Okay. John Teske receives a small portion, $20,000, out of the proceeds that are provided for State Farm for his loss of time and effort taking basically home nurse to his kids and his wife, right? He does not present a UIM claim to Wilson Insurance. The only presenters to Wilson Insurance for UIM claims are Catherine, Ellie, and Julie.
So let me follow that through. Then his money came out of something other than the UIM.
His money came from State Farm.
Okay.
And I think that's a key distinction here. Also, you know, the three elements of claim preclusion, the identity of parties, the identity of claims, and the final merits, I think what's really key is that the negligence claim that's brought against Sabrina Schrock is dismissed. There's never a negligence claim that's alleged against Wilson or one of Wilson's insureds in that first litigation. That is dismissed early on, and it was always going to be dismissed early on because they tendered their policy limits early on. What ends up happening is that claim is amended to become a declaratory action. And in every instance from Wilson Insurance in April 2014 is that the reasoning that they're denying coverage is their interpretation of their reducing clause. In the declaratory action, counsel only provides evidence of the deck page for his insurance and the UIM provisions, which include that reducing clause. It's immaterial. It's immaterial as to what is the auto accident prior beforehand. There's no consideration of negligence, no consideration of damages. And I would say that the UIM claim, the claim that's made for denial of benefits under the insurance contract, accrues in April of 2014 when Wilson denies that coverage. You can have many auto accidents that occur, and there's never a UIM claim made based on insurance coverage because insurance coverage is either granted or it's either never even brought up. Here, UIM coverage is denied based upon their interpretation of the reducing clause, and that begins a dueling cross-motion declaratory judgment in front of Sheboygan County Court.
Counsel,
yes.
Just in sum, then, if you would focus on Emily and
All right.
give us the track on Emily.
Justice Dallas' question got me off on another track. I apologize. Emily Teske is not privy to the first suit either. She is named. Well, she's not named. Her allegations in the second suit are against her based on her negligence. Wilson is named under the direct action statute as the defendant, but Emily has no interest in the first litigation in terms of Wilson. Emily has no position whether or not the reducing clause applies or does not. Emily has no position as to whether Wilson's reducing clause in the UIM provision applies.
Okay. And was Emily a party in the first action?
She was not.
And was she in privity with anyone in the first action?
I don't believe so.
And why not?
Because she doesn't have a UIM claim, that a UIM claim was not presented. It's the same thing with John Teske. In terms of UIM claims, the UIM claims that presented were the three most injured parties, right? Julie Teske, Catherine Teske, and Ellie Teske. Emily Teske did not present a UIM claim.
So again, Emily's money that she received from the minor settlement came from State Farm?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
You could have brought all of this in one lawsuit, correct? You could have alleged that Ellie was negligent in her driving and therefore there was liability insurance to be had, and that the tortfeasor who seemed to have caused all of this chaos was going to be underinsured given the injuries. Correct?
That is correct. There's nothing that prevents us from doing that. It's the question of whether or not we were required to do so, and I don't believe we were.
What troubles me is our case law that says any claim which could have been brought. And it seems to me you could have brought this claim now that's before us.
My position is we could have brought the negligence claim at any point in time within the statute of limitations. So, yes, to answer your question, we could have brought it prior, we could have brought it thereafter. At the same time. That's right.
But if you could have brought it at the same time, how do you escape claim preclusion case law, which said you have to bring all the claims you brought or could have brought in one action?
Because the two claims are not of the same origin and of the same operative facts. And
they
all
operate out of the accident. Without the November accident, you said neither would go forward.
That's true, but the UIM, there's an additional point there. The UIM claim doesn't operate until the denial of insurance coverage.
But you could have brought them together. I mean, you can say that about any automobile accident, that there's negligence by somebody and bad injuries, and you're going to get into the UIM.
Right, but you can get into the UIM, and UIM coverage is then granted or accepted. There's never a denial or never an issue on whether or not the contract provision of the reducing clause applies.
But you also agreed that negligence was at issue in both cases.
I will admit that the initial complaint filed against Sabrina Schrock to open the discovery process did allege negligence against Sabrina.
I'm not sure the subjective intent of why it was filed has anything to do with this, right? It alleged negligence.
It did, but the key portion of claim preclusion is identity of parties, identity of claims to a final claim on the to the final merits. The negligence is never taken to the final merits. That is dismissed through settlement action. The only thing that's taken through final merits in that first litigation is the insurance coverage dispute over the reducing clause.
Right, to getting back to what the Chief Justice was asking about, you alleged negligence. At that point, didn't you, based on the transactional analysis that we use for claim preclusion, didn't you have an obligation to bring the action against Emily as well or face its preclusion?
I don't believe claim preclusion attaches until you meet all three elements. I think the nature of alleging negligence against one party in the very beginning and then dismissing that claim later without it taking it to the final merits means that there hasn't been a jury, there hasn't been a fact finder to determine what is the negligence. I think that's the key distinction, is that what's the final merits of that first litigation?
So is it your position then that claim preclusion never applies when there's a settlement?
No, that's not my position. It depends on what is the nature of that first litigation versus that second litigation. I think that's the key distinction is here
tell me what the distinction is. So what settlements will satisfy the elements of claim preclusion and which won't?
I don't believe that a settling party prior taking it to the merits can be claim precluded. Okay, if that's your question. I'm saying that there can be matters that involve settlements that can still have claim preclusion. What truly matters is those three points, the final on the merits is the distinguishing point. And the final on the merits, as the Court of Appeals stated, was an insurance coverage dispute.
Did you answer Justice Dallet previously by saying that it was only State Farm that made the payment?
To whom?
Justice Dan.
John and Emily.
I believe so, yes.
All right. And the minor settlement documents and the partial settlement agreement and release speak to State Farm and the distribution of proceeds from Wilson Mutual. And the partial settlement payments are for both Ellie and Catherine. Is that correct?
I'm looking at it, Your Honor.
And payments due at the time of settlement included payments to John, Julie, Emily, and then Ellie and Catherine have...
Are you looking at the breakdown of the $255,000 from State Farm Insurance?
That's what I'm asking you. I mean, why does the minor settlement say conclude the distribution of proceeds from Wilson Mutual with respect to its UIM provisions of its policy? Why does the minor settlement say that? That's why I keep going back to the minor settlement. I'm trying to figure this out.
What I understood you saying, counsel, is that John and Emily do not have a UIM claim, so any proceeds that came out of the minor settlement agreement had to have come from State Farm. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I will...
Well, then why does the judge's order say conclude the distribution of proceeds from Wilson Mutual with respect to its UIM provisions of its policy?
So the breakdown, this could be a little clearer, to be quite honest, as I'm looking at it. But in terms of the minor settlement, it's the breakdown of the entire $500,000 that's taken both from State Farm and from Wilson Insurance. If you look at a letter dated May 30th of 2014, it's in Plaintiff's Appellate Appendix, it's document 104. It is a letter from co-counsel Victor Harding to counsel for Wilson Insurance breaking down the amounts paid to Emily Teske and John Teske from the State Farm proceeds. You look at those numbers correlate to the numbers outlined here in the chart within the petition for minor settlement.
So is that somehow part of the court's order?
The
letter?
No, I'm.
So is the court order wrong?
The court order is not wrong. I'm saying that the court order is not specific as to determination of what proceeds are going to what from where.
But they couldn't have come, because they didn't have a UIM claim, they couldn't have possibly come from anything other than State Farm, because the amounts that was spent on them was within the policy and not outside of it.
That's correct. Okay. If you look at the letter, there's listing for John Teske at $20,000, and if you go back to the petition for minor settlement, it's $20,000 from John. The letter indicates that the proceeds from State Farm are being divided up this way amongst all the Teske members.
Then what's the phrase, conclude the distribution of proceeds from Wilson Mutual with respect to its UIM provisions of the policy mean?
Well, in this instance, it means that the Teskes and Wilson Insurance had agreed to disagree to how the UIM provision would apply. We agreed to accept the limited $245,000, and that $245,000 was added to the collective pot, and then that was distributed.
Well, the UIM, Ellie could have certainly had a UIM claim.
What's that?
Ellie could certainly have had a UIM claim.
And
John wasn't wasn't a problem. I understand that, but Ellie was hurt, and she did get paid. So did Catherine.
Your Honor, are you referring to Emily or Ellie? Because there's...
Well, it said Ellie was paid $35,000. Is that correct?
Emily, it's, again, looking at this detail.
Emily was paid $45,000, unless I have my notes wrong from what I read.
Emily Teske and John Teske were not parties to the UIM coverage matter. Their proceeds come from State Farm, as indicated in this letter.
Okay, but I guess my question to you is, did Emily have any injuries from the accident?
She did. They all did.
Well, then, why is it that her payment of $45,000 must have come from State Farm? I mean, I think it's hard, at least for me, to understand how you're compartmentalizing who got paid from what, because she certainly was a minor, right?
Emily Teske was a minor.
Okay.
She was a minor. She was 18 at the time, to be quite honest. But the breakdown is the chart showing who's receiving what and what fashion. Ellie was a minor at the time, and she received $35,000 in a structured settlement.
Well, that's Ellie. Was Emily a minor as well?
I don't believe so. I'd have to double check on it.
In the settlement agreement, she signs for herself.
She's an adult at the time.
Okay,
the minors,
but she
don't.
Signed for the settlement agreement, but not as a minor.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I want to speak to, you know, the issue here, I think, is that first litigation is an insurance coverage dispute over the reducing clause, and that the only thing that's taken to the merits is the insurance coverage issue. And I think that's the key thing to claim preclusion. The issue here is what is the sort of next step for litigants moving forward? Do all insurance coverage matters? Must they be brought with negligence claims? Do they have to be tried and tried at the same time? And I referenced the bifurcation statute, and I think the bifurcation statute, in terms of its logic, is inconsistent with that holding. The bifurcation statute allows a court to break those two apart and be tried at different times. I think what Wilson is asking here is, and the logic of what Wilson is asking here is saying that an insurance coverage matter and a negligence matter taken to their merits must be tried at the same time and brought at the same time. And I think that's in conflict.
Yes. I'll tell you one of the things that concerns me about this case, as you could probably tell from questions to your opposing counsel, are the ramifications of this case. These facts are unique in some ways, but I want to make sure that the arguments don't run afoul of some pretty well-established procedures, like if you want, as an insurance company, you can go into court and get a declaratory judgment on coverage. I understand on one hand, and we've said in cases like Menards, you know, that you should bring cases all at the same time, and there are finality considerations and judicial resources considerations. And balancing that, though, with the recognized and even recently cited with approval procedure that's set up in our case law about bifurcating. You don't have to bring both at the same time, coverage and negligence. You can bring one. You could bring negligence and coverage, I suppose, in a case that maybe if the statute of limitations had not run, you bring a suit in negligence, and lo and behold, the jury gives you a huge amount of money, and the tortfeasor is really underinsured. And so then if your contract claim is still a valid claim, you could bring that. So there's this a bit of a tension between guiding principles and run the case through if you had done brought the negligence action, or a negligence action would have come to fruition first.
Well, I think in this operation, I think the case unfolds the way it does is because there's a denial of coverage. And I don't think we necessarily expect there to be denial of coverage based on our interpretation of the Wilson contract. So the negligence claim against Emily was considered, but that's something that needs to be discussed with counsel and client to determine when and how and best ways to do that. In terms of the insurance coverage matter, it unfolds organically. There's the denial of coverage in April 2014, setting out what would be the statute of limitations for that event. And then there is a back and forth between Wilson and the Teskeys as to how to proceed. And it reaches a detente of agree to disagree, pay what you think, and then we'll fight the coverage matter in a later event. The idea being that, hey, there's an open matter now, we'll amend it to become a deck action, and we'll duel it out over what is the definition of the reducing clause and how does it apply. So it's hard to sort of take that and put it back into the bag, if you will, because it happens organically the way it's set out.
Counsel, I want to turn back for a moment to the effect of the settlement in the first case.
Sure.
If the question of negligence had gone to judgment, would you agree then that claim preclusion would apply in this case?
Yes, I would say so. That if the first litigation involved what happened in the auto accident, what are the extent of the damages, and negligence is tried, yes, claim preclusion would apply in this matter. But claim preclusion doesn't, because of the reason that it's...
If that first case results in a settlement on the question of negligence, then it's fair game for those parties to bring negligence in a second case.
I believe so. I would say that again. The claim preclusion is those three bullet points. It's identity of parties, identity of claims, and was that matter taken to a final judgment? And the answer to that is no. So yes.
So our transactional analysis on what needs to be included in a complaint is affected by whether that first claim results in a settlement or instead of judgment.
I believe so, yes. I think that's pretty quite clear by the standard. I think in terms of if you bring a negligence claim and you just decide to dismiss it, you can always refile. There's lots of things that are open to litigants until you set the jury in the room and you start arguing the facts and the damages. And so there's options that are available to litigants that the Wisconsin law allows us to take. Let me look over, see if I haven't missed anything to discuss. I'll go back to the first litigation, as the Court of Appeals found, was in regards to a insurance coverage dispute. Now, we found some foreign cases that have had relatively similar sort of approaches, determining that insurance coverage disputes are different than negligence disputes, and therefore claim preclusion does not apply to those matters. And I think in this instance, the Court of Appeals got it right in that the operative fact, the origin of event for the insurance coverage dispute is when coverage is denied. If coverage is never denied, there's never a UIM insurance coverage matter. And so the operative origin is when coverage is denied. And the operative fact is what is the terms of that policy and how do they apply based upon contract interpretation.
Thank you.
I want to start my rebuttal by addressing something that Justice Ziegler asked about repeatedly and that Justice Dowlett focused in on too. Where did the money come from that was paid to John, to Ellie, to Emily, and to Catherine? According to opposing counsel, he says it came only from State Farm. Last time I checked, money is fungible. If you put it in a pot, you don't know where it's coming from. Now, he indicated that the letter of May 2014 is the basis for that. When you look at the order and the petition for approval of minor settlement, they're totally different.
But can't, but counsel, can't you only have a claim for UIM if your money, if you have injuries greater than what your own coverage pays? So isn't it true that John had no injuries because he wasn't in the accident, and Emily had obviously more minimal injuries, and that therefore neither one of them could have made a UIM claim? I understood that as what counsel was saying. So they couldn't have possibly come from anyone else other than State Farm.
Well, the problem with that, Justice Dowd, is we have $500,000 that has to be dispersed. Whether or not there's enough insurance to cover the claims, some of it is covered by State Farm. Some of it's going to be covered by the Wilson policy for UIM.
Right,
the reason why is all of their injuries were in excess of what the other policy would have covered. If you look at, except for Emily.
Only talking about Emily and John. So you agree that Emily could be limited by the policy because the policy covered her injuries. Everyone else I get, and John wasn't part of the accident, so he couldn't have possibly made a UIM claim.
I think he could have made a UIM claim.
How?
You don't necessarily have to be injured in an accident to get UIM, believe it or not. If he's making a loss of consortium claim.
Okay, but he didn't.
But if he was, Justice Dowd, and this is important here, he could have made that claim. Of course he could have made that claim. There's nothing that stops him from making that claim. And I think out-of-pocket costs, sometimes a spouse can make that claim too.
Could Julie have brought suit for the current allegation of damages for Catherine in the first lawsuit?
Could Julie have brought it for Catherine?
Yeah.
Sure, I think so.
Julie have brought a claim for Ellie in the first lawsuit?
Of course. I mean, they're minors. I mean.
But not without an.
Excuse me?
Don't you need some kind of a court order if you're going to be suing on behalf of someone?
Well, that's what we have here, though. I mean, we do have a court order. We have a petition that...
You're talking about the settlement.
Well, the settlement and the Milwaukee County court order for the settlement. Correct, Justice Bradley. Yes, correct. So to the extent that these settlements, whether or not there's privity or not privity, I mean, I think I explained why I think John... was a party in all but name. He was not formally named. We agree on that.
That really bothers me.
I know it does.
I'll tell you why. You're a party in all but name. Boy, that opens up, has the potential to open up floodgates of litigation. And we don't want that. So what, you have to be not a party in all but name. You have to be a party or you have to be in privity. You advanced the case of, I think it's Northern States, where there was a suit against a governmental employee, of course, and then you have the state and the employee being in privity. But here we don't have that kind of arrangement. So in order to meet the first element, it isn't a party in all but name. It's a party or in privity. So tell me why I shouldn't be worried about this in all but name stuff that you are advancing.
Well, Wilson Mutual was not a party and paid $245,000 to the Teskeys. Let's say that was over and done with and we didn't have this negligence action. Could Wilson be sued again and said, well, they weren't only a party in all but name.
That's
the problem I have, too.
They have in contract. I mean, we have the direction. We've had this direct action statute. Let's say you're insured by ABC. I can sue you and not name ABC, no problem. You're in privity of contract, no problem. I can not sue you and just sue ABC. So your argument really doesn't resonate because of the direct action statute. I don't care if someone in privity is a named party because the statute itself says named party or privity.
I see the red light went on, but
answer her question.
Can I answer that question? Yeah.
Yes.
Justice Bradley, I understand your concerns regarding that, and if that's correct, one of the things I do want to say on another end is because Wilson was named in the first suit when they amended the pleading, Wilson, if they wanted to sue Emily then, which I think they could have done, would have been in privity with Emily as we are today in the second act. So with that consideration in mind, I'm hoping that the court would agree with me, and Justice Bailey, you can agree on me, and I respect what you're saying about John, and I think there's an argument to be made there, as you pointed out. So without further ado, thank you very much to the court.
Thank you. Okay, we will take a break, and we'll be back for our third argument at 1:30, and if you students can stay, I'm going to come down and chat with you right away. Okay, so we are adjourned.